Good morning. Thank you very much for the introduction, Greg. It was a great pleasure to come and give a presentation to celebrate Malcolm's one of the best career in his life. My presentation is Human and Ecological Risk Assessment of Contaminated Sites, some of the key knowledge gaps. Some of the work I'm going to present is conducted by my colleagues listed in this author's list. I'm representing Professor Ravi Naidu. Ravi and Malcolm is a long association, and Ravi is extremely busy because they have just applied for the extension of the center called CRCK. That is the center. There's the center CRCK for contamination assessment remediation of the environment. So they had the interview on 22nd of November. They have been shortlisted. And before the interview, they have to go through some 10 mock interviews, so they're extremely busy. Therefore, Ravi sent his apology. That's why I'm giving him presentation, Ravi's presentation. Our association with Professor Malcolm Sumner, I was looking for some of his photos in the Google. So all the photos are in the Facebook. This is the only one I got. Our association with Professor Malcolm Sumner is in relation to our research on sodic soil and coal combustion products. Now, I believe Professor Malcolm Sumner spent around 1 year with Ravi Naidu at CSIRO. They did a lot of work on sodic soil, and they produced one of the very well-referenced book on sodic soil, distribution properties, management, and environmental consequences. In addition to that, they have written a number of papers, including this very good review on cadmium. My association, I spent 8 months with Professor Sayers and Malcolm Sumner at Newcastle, the great brothers of soil science, and we had a wonderful time there, and I worked on gypsum, particularly on flue gas desulfurization gypsum with Malcolm, and we wrote some of the papers. One of my students from Brazil joined with me PhD at Massey University, and he continued on that work, and he submitted his PhD thesis, and then now he's got a job in Massey in New Zealand. So we have a very long association with Malcolm Sumner. So my presentation, I will briefly introduce the contamination issue, definition of risk assessment, some of the elements of risk assessment, and some of the knowledge gaps. I will cover 3 aspects: bioavailability, mixed contaminants, some of the emerging contaminants, then some of the implications of knowledge gaps to remediation. Background, more than 4 million potentially contaminated sites world over, more than 750,000 sites in Europe, 500,000 sites in US, around 160,000 sites in Australia, more than 3 million sites in Asia region. It's a major issue. Contamination poses risk to soil and water resources, which are very valuable natural resources, and ecosystem, and of course human health. The problem is some of the uncertainties relating to contamination assessment is a major stumbling block hindering sustainable remediation strategies and development of contaminated sites. So this will focus on some of those knowledge gaps. What is risk assessment? Risk assessment involves an assessment of potential exposure to contamination and the severity of the effect of such exposure. Now, it formalizes the process of identification of the key issues associated with contamination, the potential hazard present, the significance of data gaps, and the level of uncertainty present. The 2 things which are very critical in risk assessment in relation to contamination are bioavailability, which is an in vivo measurement, and bioaccessibility, which is an in vitro measurement, are critical to risk assessment. Some of the components of risk assessment: firstly, we need to identify the problem, which is problem identification. Then we have to identify the receptor of that particular contamination. Then exposure assessment and toxicity assessment. Finally, risk characterization. Based on the risk, we need to go for appropriate remediation technology. Now, the problem is there are some knowledge gaps in this risk assessment. Traditionally, risk assessment is based on total contamination, a total level of contaminants, which causes overexposure, overexpenditure. Therefore, bioavailability is very critical to risk assessment. If you know what is the bioavailable component of the contamination, we can reduce the cost of remediation. So that is very critical. So what I'm going to cover is some of the key knowledge gaps. I will cover three aspects: contamination, bioavailability. I will take arsenic as an example. These are the work carried out my colleagues in the center. We have a center called CIRAR, which is part of CRCK, which is contamination assessment and remediation. And then we'll talk about mixed contaminants, because most of the sites have more than one contamination. So some of my colleagues have undertaken some work on that. Then some aspect of emerging contaminants, just flame retardants and nanomaterials. Just look at the bioavailability. Now, what is bioavailability? Bioavailability is an in vivo measurement. The absolute bioavailability is the fraction of a compound when it is ingested, inhaled, or applied to the skin that is actually absorbed and reaches the systemic circulation. So that component is bioavailability. That is when it crosses the biological membrane. The other one is the part of the bioavailability, what is known as relative bioavailability. So it's simply comparing with a standard compound. So this is the ratio of the absorbed fraction from the exposure medium in the risk assessment, for example in soil, to the absorbed fraction from a dosing media used in the critical toxicity study. The second one is bioaccessibility, which is in vitro. The fraction of a contaminant that is soluble and which is available for uptake in the circulatory system. So that is the soil component. So that can be measured by using some of chemical tests. So one is bioaccessibility, another is bioavailability. Now there are a number of methods are used for measuring bioaccessibility. Some of the most common ones are highlighted in red, SBAT, RBLAB, PBAT, and IVG. We have Nick Basta here. They have undertaken some studies on bioaccessibility measurements. But the important thing is in vitro assays may be used to predict relative bioavailability if they have been validated against a suitable animal model. So just comparing these two, bioavailability is in vitro assessment. It is an expensive animal cost, surgical cost, housing cost, multiple sampling, and also it's time-consuming and laborious, acclimation to animals, animal training, and sample taken multiple levels. Whereas bioaccessibility is an in vitro, inexpensive, pretty rapid, reproducible. But it has some issues, standardization of the methods, but the important thing is the method needs to be validated against a suitable animal model for bioavailability. Now this is the arsenic bioavailability, number of animal models, rodent, rabbit, dogs, pigs, primate, using blood, urine samples. The most common one is pig, because they are considered similar to humans in both intelligent too. Arsenic metabolism, bone development, nutrition requirement, and mineral metabolism. So at my lab, my colleagues are using pig as a model. Assessment in human is very unethical, it's very difficult. Assessment in a suitable animal model is important. So the determination of urinary excretion, blood concentration, and accumulation in target organs. So, but the important thing is you need to establish some relationship between these two. So this is the in vitro bioaccessibility. So that provides the bioaccessibility, which is a chemical test. Then you use some animal model to look at in vivo bioavailability. Then you try to establish some correlation so that you can use bioaccessibility to predict bioavailability. This is, gives you a good example of the relationship between bioaccessibility and bioavailability for arsenic. From this relationship, you can establish a regression equation. From the equation, you can predict the bioavailability. In this particular equation, you can see the regression value is close to 1, indicating it is 1-to-1 relationship. But this may not be always true. So this equation can be used to predict the bioavailability. This is one of the work conducted by Albert Suazo from my team. They've published this paper in EST. But all bioaccessibility tests may not be equal. So this is the test developed by my colleague. You can see that the regression value is close to 1, but in other tests, it may not be as close as what we're expecting. So there is some variation between these bioaccessibility tests. Bioavailability, the implication to risk, bioavailable fraction is always less than the total contaminant loading. Bioavailability varies with soil type. Using total contaminant in the risk model overestimates the risk, which can result in excessive remediation, unnecessarily cost, delay in remediation due to cost factor. Therefore, soil-based bioavailability guidelines are required. That is the first aspect of my key knowledge gap. The second one is mixes or mixed contaminant. The mixes consist of two or more substances intermingled with no constant percentage composition and with each component retaining its original properties. The majority of the site contain more than one contaminant. That's the reality. The major issues, given the knowledge gap, is health screening, investigation levels, environmental investigation level, and toxicity data. There is no agreed approach to assessing mixed contaminants. The toxicology research is dominated by studies of single component rather than assessing mixed contaminants. When you have more than one contaminant, it can reduce or enhance the toxicity due to antagonistic or synergistic process. I'll give you a couple of examples. So the presence of mixes in the field is one of the key factors causing differences between the laboratory and field-based toxicity data. This is one of our studies in which we have looked at PAH and major heavy metals in a number of gas plant sites. So that gives the PAH low molecular weight, high molecular weight, and that gives the heavy metal. So you can see most of the sites have both PAH and heavy metals. Therefore, in most cases, contaminants are present as mixers in the environment. Cases in which only a single contaminant is present are exception rather than a norm. Some of the toxicology studies, the effect of mixed contaminants. This gives the effect of DDT on the inhibition of arsenic volatilization. So when you have a DDT, it reduces the volatilization of arsenic. So that's the uninoculated site. So that's arsenic with DDT. And the last one is arsenic. So when you have DDT in the presence of arsenic, so it reduces the volatilization of arsenic. So that's the inhibitory effect. Similar effect, copper inhibits atrazine degradation. So with the increase in copper content, the atrazine degradation decreases, the half-life time increases. Just to give a last example, this is for cadmium. Cadmium inhibits the biodegradation of chlorobenzote. So when you have cadmium, the time to remove chlorobenzate increases because it inhibits the degradation. So the issue with mixed contaminant, virtually infinite number of possible contaminant mixes when organics are considered. So you have both inorganic plus inorganic, inorganic plus organics. So the interaction may occur through concentration and additive effect or independent action. So the interactions may be dose, ratio, or level dependent. What is the consequence of that? The information regarding mixes toxicity require a very large number of observations. So the mechanistically difficult to predict and interpret from the observation based on single contaminants. So our center is doing a lot of work on mixed contaminants. So some of the knowledge gap, the lack of information on the composition of contaminants in major contaminated sites in Australia, the biochemical interactions involving mixes on environment and human health, toxicology studies, some policy gap. All current policies are based on single contaminants. So that's the second aspect. The third one is some of the emerging contaminants. So this table gives some of the major emerging contaminants. Pharmaceutical, personal care products, endocrine disturbing compound, EDC, trichloroethane in groundwater, then PCE, nanoparticle, brominated flame retardant, and iron. So what I'm going to focus is just a couple of them, very briefly. Nanoparticle and brominated flame retardants. Our team has been doing a lot of work on flame retardants, which has been funded by Australian Defence Department, and we have initiated some work on nanoparticles. Flame retardants, they are major industrial uses in polymers of textile backing and electronic equipment, plastic housings, and flexible polyurethane. So as a flame retardants. They ultimately end up in the humans through waste disposal that reaches the plankton, fish, chicken, meat products, and reaches the human. Some of the health effects, it can cause reduction in sperm counts, it can cause brain damage, hypothyroidism, and degeneration of kidneys, and major other congenital problems. This has been already observed in many environment, for example, in human health, in a human milk, pork fat, biosolid, and sediments. So there has been already recorded evidence of flame retardants. We also undertake some study in South Australia looking at the distribution of these flame retardants in recreational sites, residential sites, waste dump yard, and industrial sites. Now this table gives the concentration of these flame retardants. This is the land use, and these are the flame retardant, what we call congeners. So you can see that every site is having these materials. The industrial sites have high concentration of flame retardants. We also look at firefighting foams, some of the environmental levels. We looked into major locations. Location one is a former fire training site, and location two and three are current training facilities. So you can see that former firefighting site has high concentration of firefighting foams, both in surface soil and subsoils. Just look at the toxicology of these flame retardants or firefighting foams, which we call PFOS, urease, microbial biomass, and nitrification. So it reduces all biological activities. It's very highly toxic to the environment. Finally, our nanomaterials. There are more than 300 nanoproducts already in the market. Our current work is nanomaterial for wastewater treatment and contaminant nanoparticle interactions, because most of the contaminants end up in the very fine particles. What we need is contaminant nanoparticle interactions, need to quantify data on ecotoxicology of nanoparticle, dose-response relationship. Ecotoxicology risk assessment should account for toxic effect of nanoparticles, the probability of exposure, and the possible release of this into environment. So I looked into three aspects: bioavailability, nanomaterial, and other aspects into the today's knowledge gap. So some of the conclusions: limitation toxicology and exposure data, significant uncertainty in measurement due to analytical gaps, lack of harmonization of models for soil screening levels. Risk assessment models are based on many assumptions, including toxicology data, are based on total contaminants loading, highly conservative approach, are based on single contaminant, whereas most sites contain mixes, and lack of information on emerging contaminants. The most conservative mathematical model used in risk assessment are virtually insensitive to the actual experimental data and should be viewed only as a management solution, not risk assessment technique. Therefore, bioavailability and bioacceptability measurement are critical for risk-based remediation. The in vitro bioacceptability test can be used to predict bioavailability, but regression models need to be developed for predicting bioavailability based on bioaccessibility measurement. Professor Malcolm Sumner has undertaken some pioneering work on coal combustion products, including gypsum and the amelioration of sodic soil. We are continuing this work today using nanoparticle gypsum. Thank you very much.